Tomorrow is the first Monday in October. That means the Supreme Court returns to the bench. Joining us to talk about some of the cases that will come before the justices in the new term is Professor Mimi Wesson of the University of Colorado School of Law. Welcome back to the program.
Morning, Sheila. Nice to be here.
One of the first cases the court will deal with reacts to a decision they made in their last term about how prison sentences are meted out. But that decision dealt with state law in Washington state. So why are the justices now looking at federal sentencing?
It's a good question. Well, the Washington state law that the justices struck down late last term was very similar to sentencing practices that are governed by the federal sentencing guidelines and that govern the imposition of criminal sentences in all of the federal courts. So the justices, I think, realizing the likelihood that their decision in the earlier case, Blakely versus Washington, was going to sow confusion among the federal judges, decided later in the summer to grant review in this case about whether the federal sentencing guidelines can be saved or whether they're going to suffer the same fate as the Washington law. They set this matter down for argument on the first day of the term, which I think is an indication of the justices' understanding of the urgency of this matter. I think we might see a decision in this case, perhaps in November, which would be pretty early in the term ordinarily for a major decision to be issued.
How did they change things in Washington state?
Washington, like many, many jurisdictions, used a system for imposing sentences in criminal cases that provided a range of sentences for persons convicted of certain offenses, but then provided that that range could be exceeded if certain aggravating factors were found. For example, the use of a deadly weapon or the imposition of serious bodily injury. So it had been the practice in most jurisdictions to allow judges to decide whether those extra aggravating factors were present in the case, and if they so found, to impose the higher sentence. The court held in the Blakely case that in such cases, the jury has to decide whether the aggravating factor is present and that the aggravating factor must be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. So this requirement is one that's just terrifically disruptive to what has been the typical practice in sentencing in most jurisdictions and certainly in the federal courts.
And so it's really a question of the power of the jury versus the power of the judge.
Exactly.
And so what do you expect the Supreme Court to decide?
Like most observers, I expect the court to say that the federal sentencing guidelines cannot be distinguished from the Washington system and are unconstitutional.
One of the justices has a particular connection to the issues in this case.
That's right. It's Justice Stephen Breyer, who, before he was appointed to the Supreme Court, was one of the principal architects of the federal sentencing guidelines. And I should say that those guidelines are a widely admired piece of work. They accomplish the job of giving judges some discretion to vary sentences depending upon the circumstances, but not unlimited discretion, which in the past had led to a lot of injustice and uneven sentencing. So the federal sentencing guidelines were a very thorough, careful, widely debated, and meticulously drafted piece of work, and they're now at risk. It has to be poignant for Justice Breyer to be now sitting on the court that's likely to strike down the work that he contributed to so much.
Well, just to recap, if the court goes in the direction that you expect, is it likely that people already serving time are going to have their sentences changed?
Many of them, yes. It's a little bit unclear how retroactive a decision against the constitutionality of the guidelines would be, but many expect that it would be retroactive to the point that at least those who were sentenced in the year 2000 and after would have a right to attack their sentences and ask to be resentenced.
There's another case the justices have agreed to hear that looks at whether the Constitution permits imposing the death penalty on someone who is 16 or 17 years old. What brought that issue back before the court?
Well, it was brought back before the court because some parties asked the court to review a decision by the Supreme Court of Missouri that held that the Constitution bars the imposition of the death penalty on 16 and 17-year-olds. That was an unusual decision for the Missouri court to come to because the Supreme Court, when it last considered this question in 1989, said that the Constitution permits 16 and 17-year-old capital defendants to have the death penalty imposed on them. But in the meantime, the Missouri court felt that public views about the constitutionality of the death penalty applied to juveniles and practice, that is, the frequency with which the penalty was imposed, had changed so much that the Eighth Amendment, the prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment, which depends in part on evolving standards of decency, that's the court's phrase, things had changed enough that the constitutionality of this practice had changed as well. So we know actually how many of justices are going to vote, almost to a certainty, I think. It's clear that there are 4 votes against the constitutionality of this practice. It's reasonably clear to me that there are 3 votes to uphold the earlier decision and hold that this practice is constitutional. The unpredictable votes would be those of Justice Kennedy and Justice O'Connor. They have both in recent years found that the Eighth Amendment prohibits the imposition of the death penalty on the mentally retarded, even though that overturned an earlier precedent, and prohibits the imposition of any criminal penalty on homosexual conduct. That decision also overturned a fairly recent precedent. So Justices Kennedy and O'Connor, if either one of them were to join the 4 members whom we know to be against this, the constitutionality of this practice, then the law would change.
Does the particular issue in this case come up often? Are there many juveniles convicted of capital crimes?
Very recently, there were 73 such inmates in prison in the United States awaiting execution, having been sentenced to death for crimes they committed when they were 16 or 17. So it's a penalty that's sort of imposed in theory fairly often. But in fact, since 1990, there have only been 6 executions of such defendants. I should also mention that in permitting this penalty, the United States is pretty much an outlier as far as international practice is concerned. There are only about 4 other nations that allow this practice. They're not nations that we ordinarily associate ourselves with in human rights terms. They're Congo, China, Iran, and Pakistan. It may be that the relative rarity of these kinds of sentences in the United States paradoxically would contribute to a finding that it's cruel and unusual. Unusual means, according to the court, that it's not done very often. And if it's not done very often, then eventually it may become an unconstitutional punishment.
So who is lining up on both sides of this issue?
I'm pretty sure that Justices Thomas, Scalia, and Rehnquist would vote, as they did in 1989, to uphold the practice. The 4 more liberal members of the court indicated in a dissent in the last couple of years that they thought it was shameful that this practice should be permitted to continue.
Marijuana is back before the court, medical marijuana. What's the issue in that case?
This is a really interesting case, I think. 2 California citizens who suffered from illnesses had been prescribed the use of medical marijuana for medical purposes. Federal law, of course, prohibits the possession of marijuana, even small amounts, although California law would offer them an exemption. The California exemption would not keep the federal authorities from prosecuting them. However, Congress has only a limited amount of power to enact criminal legislation, and usually its power is based on the Commerce Clause, the power of Congress to regulate commerce among the several states. These patients have argued that for Congress to prohibit them from growing, producing, and consuming small amounts of marijuana for medical purposes, Congress has no power because this conduct of theirs doesn't have any impact on commerce. They were successful in persuading the Court of Appeals for the 9th Circuit that their argument had merit. The Supreme Court has now agreed to decide whether Congress has the power to prohibit the production and use of small amounts of marijuana for medical purposes.
As you lay it out, it sounds like an easy case. What's the argument on the other side?
The government is relying on a 62-year-old case called Wickard versus Filburn. In that case, a farmer was growing some wheat in a field that was essentially in his backyard, but the court held that that behavior had enough effect on commerce to be subject to congressional regulation. Now, there are other far more recent cases on which the California patients are relying, including a very recent case in which the court held that Congress has no power to prohibit the possession of a firearm within 1,000 feet of a school. So this is really a matter of which of those precedents the court will find most apposite to the case brought by the California patients.
And are there implications beyond medical marijuana?
Yes, I think so. The power of Congress to regulate under the Commerce Clause is a very hot area of the law right now, highly contested. And what the court decides in this case, I think, will have significant implications for other cases we might see down the road. For example, if these patients win their case, I would expect to see a case before long in which someone argues that the production and consumption of small amounts of marijuana for purposes of pleasure is also not sufficiently in the stream of commerce to justify congressional prohibition.
Mimi Wesson is a professor at the University of Colorado School of Law in Boulder, Colorado. She joined us from NPR's Bureau in Chicago. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Sheila.
When she's not teaching law students, Mimi also writes legal thrillers under her full name, Marianne Wesson. Her third novel, just published, is Chilling Effect.